The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
You want to hold your applause for the real stars, but I'm Morris Williams, and it's my pleasure to welcome each of you to the Free Library of Philadelphia. In the interest of the new digital communications, would I please remind you to turn off your cell phones so that we can enjoy these wonderful speakers that we have tonight. I think we're in for a great double feature treat, and we have two great authors with great stories to tell, but I think that there are two themes in particular that I would highlight and encourage you to think about as you listen to their comments. The first is leadership, because I think that Andrew Jackson, General Grant, General Sherman, all demonstrated great aspects of leadership that are admirably portrayed in these books that these gentlemen have written. And the second is the whole aspect of the Union of the United States. We know that Grant and Sherman were involved in the Civil War, but I think what is not fully appreciated until you read Bill Brand's book is the extent to which Andrew Jackson's focus was on preserving the Union and the extent to which he had to wrestle with issues that foreshadowed the ultimate tragedy of the Civil War. Be sure and buy both of these books. They are outstanding, and you can buy them upstairs and have the authors sign them. They will be speaking, and I will introduce them in that order. Bill Brandt, who will speak first, has written this great book about Andrew Jackson. And in addition to the material that's in your program, I would simply highlight my excitement that this is a distinguished professor at the University of Texas who still teaches freshmen in a survey course about American history. And I think that is so essential in terms of both the breadth of his knowledge and interest as well as his ability to excite freshmen in their pursuit of American history. The second dimension of his teaching is at the graduate level and a focus on American foreign policy. So you will see that focus in his writings. As I think most of you know, one of his earlier books was on the first of American, Benjamin Franklin, and really, of course, he was our first diplomat. So foreign policy, undergraduate teaching, and a great ability to provide insights, I think, are hallmarks of Bill Brandt's. Charlie Flood has the great ability to, as you see in the program, to have been a writer since his early days as a graduate at Harvard. What the program doesn't tell you is that he was accepted to Harvard Law School, and he decided that he would pursue a program in his first year at Harvard Law School, which went something like this in his own words. I went to every class, took good notes, spent the afternoon studying the law. In the evening, I worked on my novel until I became sleepy and promptly went to bed. The result was that at the end of the year, I passed, standing midway in my class, and had written most of my novel, paren. I concluded from this that most first-year law students overstudy, don't sleep enough, and worry too much about how they're doing. Obviously, he gave up the law and went on to write a variety of fascinating books, not only about Grant and Sherman, but Robert E. Lee, and focusing on his last years. And he and his wife now live in Kentucky, which has obviously been a critical state, both in the life of Andrew Jackson as well as in the Civil War and the unfolding between Grant and Sherman. So without further ado, would you please give a great Philadelphia welcome to two outstanding authors.
Thank you, Morris, for that very kind introduction, and thank you to the Free Library for having me here. And thank you all for coming tonight. One of the attractions of addressing an audience like this for someone like me who's a teacher is that I know that none of you have to be here. There's no midterm. It's not going to be on the final. I flatter myself to think that I make my classes interesting to my students, but I all know that they have ulterior motives in coming to class, so I can assume no ulterior motives on your part. I want to talk a little bit tonight about how it is that I wrote a book on Andrew Jackson. I'm not going to tell you a whole lot about what's in the book because, well, Woodrow Wilson, who was a career academic before he became president of the United States, and someone who appreciated books, no less, once said that he would never read another book if he could have 15 minutes with the author. I've been told that I've been given 20 minutes, so I have to talk about things other than the book, at least for part of that time, otherwise you won't buy my book. I wrote a book about Andrew Jackson because I was aware of a considerable discrepancy between the appreciation for Jackson during his lifetime and the appreciation for Jackson during our lifetimes. And I've been teaching American history for about 25 years, and during that time I've come to appreciate, well, I knew enough about Jackson to know that for the first, probably half or even, you could almost stretch it to two-thirds of the 19th century, Jackson was considered pretty much throughout all parts of the country, with a minor exception, New England, I suppose, and I don't know how he was appreciated in Philadelphia, but he was considered the towering figure of his time. Now, at some point, I wanted to try to quantify this. I don't know exactly why, but I wanted to see if there's any way of measuring it. In the 19th century, there were no such thing as public opinion polls, so I couldn't see what Gallup had to say and what Roper and what the responses to the NBC Times latest poll was. But I did the next best thing, at least the best thing I could think of, and that was, and you can decide for yourselves whether it was a good idea or not, but I went to an atlas of American history, and I looked in the index of the atlas to see how many places in this country are named for Andrew Jackson. Now, they don't, needless to say, all those Jacksonvilles and Jackson counties and Jackson Lake, they don't say Andrew Jacksonville, so I'm going to assume that most of them are for Andrew Jackson. There's the occasional, I suppose, Stonewall Jackson that slipped in. But for the most part, when I find all of the towns, counties, et cetera, that are named for Andrew Jackson, for Jackson, I can assume that they're named for Andrew Jackson. And the thing that I discovered is that there are more such place names for Andrew Jackson than for anybody else in American history. And after I got to working on the subject, I had a number of people come up to me, the men, and explain, people that I knew, for example, as Jack, and explain that their given name was actually Andrew Jackson Smith, or whatever it might be. So the Jacksons, the Andrew Jackson, was kind of crawling out of the woodwork. Anyway, so I was aware that Jackson was held in tremendous esteem by his contemporaries, not by all his contemporaries. I can say in, I think, full fairness, that Andrew Jackson was the most popular figure of his time. And by his time, I mean, from about 1815, more precisely from the morning of January 8th, 1815, until beyond his death, the most popular figure of his time. But he was also, this might sound like a paradox, but it really isn't, he was also probably the most unpopular figure of his time. It is characteristic of, I think, many great leaders, and Morris suggested that leadership could be a theme for this evening, and it's certainly a theme in my book on Jackson. Many great leaders have this kind of divisive effect on people. They generate great devotion in their followers, but if you don't share that devotion, because many of them are very strong individuals, there's a kind of, well, in some cases, revulsion that sets in. And so Jackson was esteemed, admired, almost revered by a great many people in his generation. But there were others who thought that he was almost the devil incarnate. Anyway, but they all admitted that Jackson was the towering figure of his time. In fact, if I wanted to push this point, I could almost go so far as to say that between, well, I should tell you this, that Andrew Jackson was commonly considered to be the second coming of George Washington. After the Battle of New Orleans, he was commonly accounted, he was often called simply the hero. If you mentioned the word, the phrase, the hero, In 1820, everybody knew who you were talking about. Some people took it quite seriously. Other people took it as maybe ironically, but they all knew you were talking about Andrew Jackson. So, in Jackson's lifetime, he was the greatest figure around. By the end of the 20th century, Jackson had fallen into, what shall I say, not disgrace would put it too strongly, but fallen into the shadows of American history. Scholars of the presidency, students of American history, could still have told you that if you wanted to rank presidents in terms of their effect on their times and on subsequent history, Jackson would make the top probably 6 or 8. But if you stop people on the street and ask them what they knew about Andrew Jackson, they might be able to tell you, Jackson's the guy on the $20 bill who was having a great hair day when that illustration was drawn. But other than that, well, in fact, other than that, what people remember or know about Andrew Jackson is often rather negative. One of the things that I think all school kids these days know about Andrew Jackson is he was the one who forced the Cherokees out of Georgia along the Trail of Tears. Now, in fact, it's considerably more complicated than that. Jackson wasn't even president when the Cherokees finally evacuated Georgia. But the point is clear enough, and it's not all that inaccurate, because Jackson's policy toward Native Americans was quite harsh, to put it, I won't say charitably, but to put it fairly. And so I had, in fact, just after the book came out, I had somebody come up to me. I don't know his background at all, but he came up to me. It was at a book signing, and he didn't want to buy a book. What he wanted to do was to pose a question to me, maybe a challenge to me or something. He came up and he looked me right in the eye, and in all seriousness, I'd never met him before, he said, "I hope you don't admire Andrew Jackson." And, well, I knew sort of I could imagine his politics, I mean, from this comment, because Jackson doesn't fit well with a modern, let's call it a liberal sensibility. So anyway, the reason I wrote a book about Andrew Jackson was I needed to try to figure out what it was about Jackson and his times that made him seem the towering figure. And then implicitly I'd figure out, I think, why Jackson has fallen out of favor. And one of the things that I discovered was, I guess the principal thing I discovered, is that the reason Jackson was so revered during his day was that he was considered to be the man who had saved the Union. Not once, but twice. Once on the battlefield, once as president. He saved the Union the first time in 1815 at the Battle of New Orleans. Those people who remember anything about the Battle of New Orleans today tend to think of it as something of a historical footnote. The War of 1812 generally is perceived as something of a historical footnote, because the War of 1812 was that war that started over, well, issues that don't mean anything to us today, and it ended in a tie. In fact, officially, that was the basis for the post-war settlement, the return to the status quo ante bellum. So there was this 3-year war, and at the end, both sides, the Americans and the British, just said, okay, forget it, we'll pretend it never happened. And the Battle of New Orleans in particular is often seen as a footnote to a footnote, because one thing that students all learn, because it seems kind of this curiosity of history, is that the battle was fought 2 weeks after the treaty that was going to end the war was signed in what's now Belgium, the town of Ghent. And so obviously it couldn't have been very important, because it was fought after the war was over. Well, that's one of those approximations to history, actually, that misleads more than it informs. Because, needless to say, those people who fought at New Orleans had no idea that a treaty had been signed. But moreover, it's worth remembering, and since I mentioned Woodrow Wilson earlier, Woodrow Wilson certainly knew that you can negotiate a treaty and you can sign a treaty like the Treaty of Versailles, but until it's ratified, it doesn't count at all. And the Treaty of Ghent, as it would be called, hadn't been ratified at the time the Battle of New Orleans was fought. The Battle of New Orleans was fought for the fate of the Union. Morris mentioned that the Union is going to be a theme tonight. Well, Andrew Jackson saved the Union at New Orleans in January of 1815. The British strategy in attacking New Orleans and the Gulf Coast was to open the way to the Mississippi. The British fully intended to drive up the Mississippi to connect with another British army moving south from Canada and split the western half of the United States from the eastern half of the United States, to hand the western half either back to the Spanish or to the Indians to set up a buffer state against American expansion. Jackson realized that if the British won, it would be the beginning of the end of the Union. Already in the East, Federalists in New England were mumbling about secession, and if the West were peeled off, there would be almost nothing left of the Union. So, when Jackson gathered his forces at New Orleans, he knew that the fate of the Union was at stake. And it was more than just the Union. Because Jackson, who was born in 1767, who came of age with American independence and the emergence of American republicanism with a small r, which was going to develop into American democracy with a small d during Jackson's lifetime, fully believed that the fate of American republicanism was at stake. If the Union fell apart, then the notion that people could govern themselves was at serious risk. So, against all odds, against all expectations, Jackson won this stunning victory at New Orleans. It was a victory that was a testament to Jackson's will as much as anything else. No one, the British, most Americans, even the soldiers fighting under Andrew Jackson, initially didn't believe that Jackson and his forces stood a chance. But Jackson believed that it must happen, and therefore it would happen. And he convinced those soldiers, and talk about a motley crew. The army at New Orleans consisted of army regulars, militia from several states. It consisted of French nationals and Spanish nationals, neither of whom particularly wanted to be there, but Jackson wouldn't let them leave and made them fight. It consisted of free African Americans. It consisted of slaves, Indians from various tribes. There were some Haitians there. There were pirates. And the only thing that held all this group together was Jackson's will and his insistence that they fight and they win. When Jackson won at New Orleans in this astonishing victory, 2,000 British killed, wounded, or taken prisoner against less than 24 American casualties. It seemed to the rest of the country as though God himself had delivered the Union to live for another day. And God's agent was Andrew Jackson. Jackson became famous as a result of this. One thing led to another, and he ran for president during the 1820s. The second thing that people of Jackson's... Oh, I told you that he saved the Union again when he was president. Oh, yeah, I have to get that in. He saved the Union the first time on the battlefield. He saved the Union the second time in the White House. Because while he was president, the question of, well, the perennial question that wouldn't be answered until, pick your Civil War battle, Gettysburg maybe, of where sovereignty in this federal system actually lay. Did it lie with the states, or did it lie with the central government? Jackson, surprisingly enough, maybe surprisingly, I don't know, he was a states' rights man in most things. Jackson took such a narrow view of the prerogatives of the central government. Well, for anyone who lives in Philadelphia, if you don't know, I need to remind you of Jackson's battle with Nicholas Biddle and the Second Bank of the United States. And Jackson had two fundamental complaints against the Bank of the United States. In the first place, it was unconstitutional, despite what John Marshall had said. Now, in the celebrated case of McCulloch versus Maryland, Marshall had said that the Bank of the United States was constitutional. Jackson said, I don't care what John Marshall said. I think it's unconstitutional. Now, this is often taken as evidence of Jackson's arrogance. In fact, it's evidence of the fact that in Jackson's day, the notion of judicial supremacy, that when the Supreme Court speaks, that silences all debate, that was a minority view. Jackson said, okay, fine, Justice Marshall can interpret the Constitution for the Supreme Court, for the judiciary, but that doesn't bind me. The people elected me to, and they elected my conscience as well. Anyway, so a dispute developed between Jackson and the Bank of the United States. He thought it was unconstitutional. Another dispute developed between South Carolina and the rest of the Union over a tax bill. more precisely a tariff, that the South Carolinians thought was too high. And the South Carolinians decided that they were going to nullify, which means to forbid the enforcement of this law. The federal tax agents weren't going to get to operate in South Carolina. And if the federal government tried to enforce the law, South Carolina was going to secede. Now, Andrew Jackson was a states' rights man in nearly all aspects. Even in such an innocuous matters, in 1832, there was a cholera outbreak in the United States, and a group of ministers came to the White House and implored Andrew Jackson to declare a national day of prayer. And he said, "Much as I'd like to, the Constitution doesn't give me authority to do it. Go to your states, talk to your governors." But Jackson drew the line when states' rights even hinted at secession. So Jackson was that almost oxymoronic individual. He was a states' rights unionist. States' rights in most things, but don't challenge the Union. And when South Carolina did challenge the Union, Jackson responded by ordering his Secretary of War to prepare an army of 200,000 men that he was personally going to lead into South Carolina. And when a South Carolina congressman dropped by the White House at the height of the crisis and said he was heading back to South Carolina, and did the president have any message for his constituents, Jackson said, "Yes, I do. Please tell my friends in South Carolina," and in fact, Jackson was a native of South Carolina, "please tell my friends in South Carolina that should I encounter any one of them even hinting at secession, I will hang every one of them from the highest tree I can reach." When Andrew Jackson, the hero of New Orleans, talked that way, South Carolina had to pay attention. South Carolina decided that perhaps discretion was the better part of valor and backed down. So, for the second time, Jackson had held the Union together. The other thing that Jackson was appreciated for in his time, and this is, I don't know, maybe this is the most lasting significance of the Jackson phenomenon, was Jackson was the man who made, no, Jackson was the man who symbolized the emergence of democracy in this country. Until Jackson, presidents were expected to be, or at least were, from what could be called the aristocracy. Presidents had been favored by birth, by wealth, by education, by connections. When Andrew Jackson came along, he broke the mold. He didn't do it all by himself. He rode a wave of democracy. In the 1820s, for the first time, individuals could vote for president. Well, not exactly. We still don't vote directly for president. We still vote for electors. But until the 1820s, in most states, the electors were not chosen by popular vote. They were chosen by the state legislatures. You may remember, if you were paying close attention during the election of 2000, that when the count and then the recount got hung up in Florida, briefly, the Florida legislature talked about simply deciding the case for themselves. And it was perfectly constitutional. Did you know? You don't have a constitutional right to vote for president? The Constitution simply says the states shall choose electors. And if your state decided to change whatever rules or laws it has now, it could deprive you of that vote. But anyway, realistically they can't, because ever since Andrew Jackson, democracy has been the touchstone of this country's political system. And in particular, the presidency has been the office most peculiarly associated with democracy and with the people. Jackson, an orphan boy at the age of 14, his father died before he was born. His mother died during the American Revolution when he was 14. He was cast out upon the world with no money, no connections, very little in the way of education. Whatever he made himself. And when he ran for president in the 1820s, he seemed to ordinary Americans, who for the first time were able to vote in large numbers, to be an embodiment of their ideals of what this country ought to be about. People identified with Andrew Jackson in a way no one had ever been able to identify with George Washington. No mother could say to her son, "Grow up to be like George Washington." Because if you weren't born like George Washington, you wouldn't end up like George Washington. But people could say to Andrew, mothers and fathers could say to their children, "Grow up to be like Andrew Jackson." because Andrew Jackson didn't start out the way Andrew Jackson finished up. Anyway, Jackson is elected in, oh my gosh, one of the dirtiest political campaigns in history. If you think politics today is low and dirty, read my book. Anyway, and so all of a sudden the presidency becomes the office that the people own themselves. I mentioned the campaign of 2000. I was struck during the campaign of 2000 when I was watching one of the presidential debates. And the two debaters, as you will recall, were George W. Bush and Al Gore. And these are two men who, if there exists a political aristocracy in this country, they were both born right into it. They were both born wealthy. They had education. Between the two of them, they have three Ivy League degrees. And I was watching this particular debate, and I was struck by the fact that these two men, who were favored in all aspects, went out of their way. They knocked themselves out to demonstrate that I'm the one, each wanted to claim, I'm the one who's just more ordinary folks, who has just the common touch. The presidency is the office in this country to which that standard, the common touch standard, is most obviously connected. It's perfectly legitimate to describe a senator, for example, as the distinguished senator from Pennsylvania. But don't call a president distinguished, or you'll get the president's spokesman to come out and explain, no, he's just an ordinary guy. Presidents are supposed to roll up their sleeves and get down and dirty with the ordinary folks. We owe it all to Andrew Jackson. I've used up all my time, and I haven't even gotten to tell you about Rachel Jackson and one of the great love stories of American history. For that, you'll simply have to read the book. Thank you very much.
Good evening. Thank you very much for the introduction, Morris, and thank you for a great talk. And to try to put what I have to say into the sweep of American history, I think it's worth pointing out that Sherman was born in 1820 and Grant in 1822, and in 1821, to give you this overlap, Andrew Jackson ended effectively his military career. However, you come to the 1840s and you have Sherman graduating 2 years ahead of Grant at the Military Academy, and Grant 2 years later at West Point. And you then are right on the edge of the Mexican War, in which both men served, although Sherman was unhappily, from his point of view, relegated out to California. And in 1845, having lived to see the bill for the annexation of Texas, why Andrew Jackson is gone. But there is a continuity there, and there certainly is a continuity among men of the West. I mean, Tennessee is thought of as the South, but it certainly is the West, and the Mississippi River figured enormously in all of the story, both Professor Brand's story and my story. Perhaps in the question and answer period, somebody might draw me out about the technique I've used in selecting the 12 topics for the 12 books I've written. By the time that 2003 came around, I think I had developed a pretty good technique for seeing the... sorry about this noise. It'll stop now. For seeing the hole in a subject you thought nothing more could be written about profitably, but the hole big enough to drive a truck through. That is my thesis, and I stand behind it, and will explain to you in a minute exactly how it applies here. I wanted to write something about the Civil War, and I wanted to write something about Grant. And looking at what was out there, and I had been in the field of the Civil War before, I almost blinked when I realized that no one had ever written a book about the friendship and the partnership between Grant and Sherman. For 145 years, everybody, and I mean everybody, had walked past this idea. So my thesis is that this was a friendship not only fascinating in itself, but one with enormous military and political consequences. And you don't have to wait for the end of the Civil War to see it. We sometimes forget, as Professor Brand has pointed out, forget some other things. We've forgotten that in the summer of 1864, Lincoln thought he was going to lose the election. And had he lost it, nobody can say precisely what the outcome of the Civil War had been. The North was heartily sick of the war, and the Democrats were doing so well that Lincoln asked every member of his cabinet to sign a document promising that when this defeat came, which he thought would come, that they would participate in an orderly transition so there would not be complete chaos. Suddenly comes the news from Atlanta that Sherman has captured Atlanta, and every bit of the opposition, the most vocal, the most effective opposition, is silenced. Lincoln wins the election, and they go on, obviously, to the victory. Now, as to whether they were the two men, because there certainly are other names, in the grand review held in Washington at the end of the war, of the million men under arms, 135,000 participated in a two-day parade. And on the reviewing stand was President Andrew Johnson, having just succeeded the assassinated President Lincoln, and to his right was Grant, and to his left was Sherman. Not Philip Sheridan, the great cavalry leader, not George Gordon Meade, the victor of Gettysburg, but Grant and Sherman. So there I stand or fall. I had my subject, Grant and Sherman, but soon I realized that I was writing not about two people, but about four people. Two highly intelligent women, the wives of these men, and these men deeply respected and appreciated the intellects, and I use that word advisedly, of their wives. Bruce Catton said of the relationship between Julia Dent Grant and Ulysses S. Grant, it was one of the great, beautiful, romantic American love stories. To borrow a phrase you've heard recently, read the book. Julia's memoirs were not published until 1988. They are charming. They not only reveal this love story in a very poignant way, but also a marvelous picture of the times in which she lived, starting as she did as a daughter of a slaveholding family in Missouri, ending up as in the White House. But also, I think that they give that overall sense of what I want to stress was true here, that the mutual respect between these two men and their wives. There are a lot of letters extant, not a bit during the war of, don't you worry your pretty little head about this, I'll fight the war, you keep the home front going. So Grant's memoirs, which have been praised across the last century by people as diverse as Mark Twain, Gertrude Stein, and Edmund Wilson, are really beautifully written. And they stop with the end of the war, but they are probably the best memoirs of their kind that have ever been written. Sherman and Ellen were a different story. Ellen Ewing Sherman. It was a difficult marriage, but I'm sure some of you have seen marriages like this. It's impossible to imagine either of them being married to anyone else. Both women were quick to come to the defense of their husbands when they were attacked, and their husbands were attacked frequently by the press, by politicians, and a lot of rivalry going on among other generals. Ellen Sherman in particular was a tigress in defense of her cump, C-U-M-P, as his family nickname had it. When I got into something as unexpected to me as the fact that I was dealing with four people, I had to see what was the influence of these wives beyond just the fact that had they not been the wives, these men never, ever would have amounted to anything, and they certainly didn't amount to much for quite a long time. The influence of Ellen Sherman on her husband, three of her four brothers became generals in the Union Army, and two of them were wounded. Here's Ellen writing Sherman more than 2 years before his march to the sea. Quote, I hope that this will be a war not only of emancipation but of extermination, and that all under the influence of the foul fiend may be driven like the swine into the sea. May we carry fire and sword into their estates until not one habitation is left standing. So that's Ellen. And obviously, she thought the Confederacy was in the hands of the devil. So let's take a look at these two men, isolating them for a moment from the picture of them as half of couples. Grant was the descendant of Scots. He was a reserved Scot, but not a dour or humorless one. He was tone deaf and knew it, and said on one occasion, "I know two tunes. One is Yankee Doodle, and the other isn't." They both fell afoul of a general named Halleck, who was a duplicitous, ambitious, capricious man. And Halleck appeared senior in rank to Grant after Shiloh and calmly sidelined Grant and began, instead of Grant's momentum, and Grant frequently used the term, keep the ball rolling, quite a modern sounding statement, but he did indeed say it repeatedly. Halleck, by contrast, when the Confederates were in complete disarray, not a chance of counterattacking, off 20 miles away after Shiloh at a place called Corinth, he would march a couple of miles and stop and entrench for the night, get his cannon up, and then go on another maybe 2 miles the next day, and Grant observed that it was a siege on the move. Now, Robert E. Lee is justly famous as a great horseman, riding traveler, but Grant was fully his equal as an equestrian. He arrived at West Point a very slight, slender cadet, but with a lifetime of experience with horses already. The West Point stables had a villain named York, a big chestnut sorrel, whose idea of how to amuse himself was to get a cadet on his back, then rear up, and then lie down and roll over the cadet. And everyone was intimidated, if not terrorized, by York. And Grant politely came up to the riding master and said, "I think I could work with this horse, sir." And the riding master accepted with pleasure. Grant pulled out a pistol and took the butt and hit York between the ears, a little above the eyes, but between the ears twice, and York understood that things were going to be a little different. The cadets used to come down in the afternoons when they had some of their little free time to watch Grant school York. And they, before Grant was finished, set a record for jumping over a high bar that lasted at West Point for 25 years. Now, this is not really a sports story. This is a story about a skill that came in very handy for Grant and, indeed, a good segment of the American Army, United States Army, at the Battle of Monterey during the Mexican War. The American troops had gone through the city of Monterey pretty quickly and had run out of ammunition at the far side of the city. They were under fire there, and there were quite a few Mexican troops still on these side streets with one avenue going back to where the supplies were. And a volunteer was called for to go back and tell the supply people. And Grant, interestingly enough, was both a supply person and a man who fought at the front all the time, every chance he got. And so Grant volunteered. Nobody thought he was going to get through alive, but somebody had to try to get that message back. He galloped through the one main avenue with everybody shooting at him from the side streets on the left-hand side. He figured this out. He hung down on his horse on the right-hand side and managed to get through alive and saved the day at Monterey. By the time of the Civil War, Grant's innate personality created this impression in a Union general who met him for the first time. He looked as if he had determined to drive his head through a brick wall and was about to do it. Abraham Lincoln said of him, "When Grant once gets possession of a place, he holds on to it as if he had inherited it." Now, was Grant simply a bulldog? Even to this day, we have a stereotype that is singularly inappropriate. At Vicksburg, against the advice of Sherman, and certainly against the advice of all the people in Washington who knew about it. He took some ships down the river at night, ships filled with men, ammunition, supplies, running past 7 miles of Confederate cannon, went down the river at night, pulled it off, didn't lose a man, ended up south of Vicksburg in a position where he was able to start maneuvering to get at the city's most defensible side. Now, what is particularly interesting, and I have to say, I think most people, and I guess I mean most writers and students of this, have not picked up on this, is that in Grant's maneuvering before he finally put the noose around Vicksburg, he cut away from his supply lines. He lived off the land, and Sherman, who was right with him, took good note of this, and of course later employed these techniques on a much greater scale during his brilliant and undoubtedly brutal but efficient marches to the sea that I submit actually saved more northern and southern lives in the long run. At Chattanooga, a battle that is much forgotten, after the great Confederate victory at Chickamauga, the Confederates came up to Chattanooga, which is a city in a bowl of hills, and they were on the ridges above Chattanooga, 70,000 Confederates on places like Lookout Mountain, which are 1,200 feet above the city, 40,000 Union troops down in the city, only wondering which morning the 70,000 men would come down on them and wipe them out. Grant arrives, and within 72 hours, goes on the offensive and pulls off the great victories of Lookout Mountain, Missionary Ridge, and as I say, a rather neglected but major battle. After Cold Harbor, when Grant and Lee were facing off against each other in Northern Virginia, in one morning, Grant lost 7,000 men in the engagement, the one engagement he said he wished he'd never gotten into. But every one of his predecessors with the Army of the Potomac would have fallen back on Washington, licked his wounds, never dreamt of doing anything other than trying to recover from this. In 9 days later, Lee and his generals awoke to find that these campfires they'd been watching the night before were just that. There were no men around it. Overnight, Grant had moved 115,000 men to the east in a move to go around Robert E. Lee, turn his flank. Only Robert E. Lee could possibly have responded as he did, and this thus create another year or so of war. But the point is that when Grant had room to maneuver in the west, he used it abundantly and taught Sherman how to do it as well. When he finally was locked against Lee, and Lee was in the same problem of having to defend Richmond, then indeed you did have something that does look like a bit of a predecessor of World War I trench warfare. Now, to the other half of this remarkable partnership and warm friendship, Sherman was one of 11 children. When he was 9, his father died bankrupt and leaving the family penniless, and Kump was taken into the nearby house of a very influential family named Ewing. Ellen Ewing, aged 5, looked at this boy who was to be raised as if he were her brother, and later recalled, quote, "I peeped at him with great interest." 21 years later, they were married. Like Grant, Sherman was a West Pointer. Imagine this tall, lanky young man with wiry red hair who was constantly in nervous motion and talked incessantly. His demerits at West Point, and his only demerits at West Point, were for talking in ranks, even on dress parades. He could not stop talking, and he also had these rather innocent but forbidden parties in his room at night, which of course meant talking on to the dawn, listening to Sherman. Like Grant, he resigned from the Army during the pre-war years, and again, like Grant, was a pre-war failure, although he failed on a higher policy level. William Tecumseh Sherman, in the 4 years before the Civil War, had 4 different jobs. In Grant's case, his career came to a bad end, or the first military career he had came to a bad end out in California. Stationed out there without Julia, he missed her desperately. He started drinking. He resigned to avoid court-martial for being drunk while handing out money to troops on a payday. Came back to St. Louis, which was near where Julia's family was, and at one point was reduced to peddling firewood from a wagon on a street in St. Louis. I have in my book an illustration of a pawn ticket, the photocopy, if you will, of a pawn ticket. That pawn ticket for $22 was what Grant pawned his gold watch for 2 days before Christmas in 1857 so he could buy Julia, who was then some months pregnant with their fourth child and the other three children, Christmas presents. 11 years later, he was elected President of the United States. So, if there were ever two soldiers who needed a war, now that may seem... I know, I deliberately put it that way. But by contrast, if you were to look in, say, the 1930s, the run-up to the early 1940s with the United States Army, the first team was already there. MacArthur, Marshall, Bradley, Patton, Eisenhower. Before the Civil War, nobody ever would have dreamt of including on any short list of anybody to be anything, Grant and Sherman. Grant came into the war as a colonel in charge of 1,000 men. He ended up commanding 1,000,000. And an important thing in judging Grant is his administrative skill and abilities, which his headquarters, even on the bloodiest battles, were turning out hundreds of letters a day, sometimes on all sorts of topics that had nothing to do with the immediate matter at hand. Now, the dynamics of this friendship, if ever there were two men who needed each other, underneath Sherman, in Sherman, was still that little boy whose father had died. He had a support system, and a pretty strong support system in some ways, with his prominent in-laws, but he needed somebody to give him that unqualified support, and he got it from Ulysses S. Grant. Now, this was to be a two-front war, Grant in the north eventually, and Sherman with a moving front coming down from Chattanooga to Atlanta, Atlanta to Savannah, then turning that whole front around and coming up. So it really was two men and a war with two fronts on it. Grant and Sherman were two men of the West, the old Northwest. The term the Midwest had not yet been coined. They viscerally understood the importance of the Mississippi River. They understood that the river was the key to the control of the continent, the key to the outcome of the war. Early in the war, Sherman begged Lincoln to keep him always as a second in command. That didn't happen. Sherman was sent to Louisville to command the Kentucky front. He began to think the Confederates were there in front of him in overwhelming force, which was not the case, had a nervous breakdown. Cincinnati Commercial came out with a headline, General William T. Sherman, insane. Enter Halleck, the duplicitous Halleck. Sherman is relieved of command, but Halleck, aware of some of Sherman's connections in Washington, decided to give him a job training troops, and then, in the greatest favor that Halleck did the Union cause, he made Sherman the supply officer back down the Cumberland River as Grant was operating towards and then fighting the Battle of Fort Donelson. Grant becomes aware of this officer back down the river. Grant had been a supply officer. Sherman, along the way, had been a supply officer. Grant, in effect, said, who is this guy who's sending me stuff before I even know I need it myself? In the middle of the battle, two regiments arrive. Nurses arrive. Bandages arrive. Food arrives. More horses arrive. All this stuff arrives. So as soon as that battle was over, he got to know Sherman, who before that, they had just seen each other in passing at West Point and one casual encounter on a street in St. Louis before the war. So he takes Sherman under his wing. They take each other's measure at the Battle of Shiloh and never look back. For 2 years, they worked hand in glove out there. And the friendship side of this, Sherman once described in these words, "We were as brothers, I the older man in years, he the higher in rank." So Grant gave Sherman that unconditional support that Sherman had to have, and in Sherman, Grant found a brilliant subordinate who, because of that support, eventually became capable of great independent actions. After 2 years of working together and working often side by side, Grant was called east. In Cincinnati, on his way to Washington, he and Sherman sat down, smoked many cigars for 2 days in a hotel room, and when they came out of there, Sherman, who'd already been fighting Joseph E. Johnston, the other great general besides Robert E. Lee that the Confederacy had, Sherman famously said, he was to go for Lee, and I was to go for Joe Johnston. One of the interesting insights into this friendship is how the brilliant, better read Sherman was mystified by Grant's military intuition. He just could not believe that this plain-spoken man of whom he was so fond could look at a map, know just what to do, look at a battlefield, know just what to do, listen to a report, know just how to respond. But eventually he began to realize that Grant was really the greater of the two great generals and was a master at what he did. So here is my summation, the defense, if you will, professor, of my thesis. It was a friendship and not just a partnership. To work, their partnership had to have that added commitment that comes from a warm friendship. Grant, with Sherman around, was an entirely different person, and Sherman often was very entertaining, and there were even cases of what we might today call kidding around when Julia was sitting there, Grant was sitting there, and Sherman was sitting there, and they were all engaging in pretty light banter with each other. Not what you think of now from the middle of a truly bloody war, but that did happen. So what I see here is that this particular partnership had that commitment, and they were the two men who, with Lincoln's increasing support and admiration, won the Civil War. Thank you so much. You've been... Just one word before I go do what I'm supposed to do, which is not a hand scratched a head, not a foot twitched. I appreciate it more than I can tell you. Thank you.
Well, I'm delighted to say that we now have an opportunity to ask these two wonderful writers and historians questions. As many of you know, I'm Elliot Shellcrott, the president of the library, and we have volunteers with us on each side with microphones. And we'll ask you to please raise your hand, and we'll get a microphone to you so that everybody can hear. So please raise your hand, and we'll get a microphone to you. Okay, go right to that, on our way, right to the back there.
Yes, would you discuss the last 25 years of the American presidency in relationship to the previous 200 years? And how it might be seen in the year 2205? Thank you.
Well, I guess we begin with an appropriately small question, so let's see. Well, one of the things that I will say is that every president lives with the accomplishments of Andrew Jackson. I mentioned in my talk about how presidents are expected to show a common touch. As Bill Clinton famously, and I think very effectively put it, they're supposed to feel the pain of ordinary people. So if there's a disaster in New Orleans, the president's supposed to get down there and demonstrate that he's right with the American people. Now, let's see, how can I summarize the last 25 years of the... I suppose I could ask you, is there anything in particular about the last 25 years? Shall we go 30 years? Well, I'll try this. I will say that in certain respects, George W. Bush is a modern Jacksonian. And I would say this in a couple of respects. One is that what President Bush is attempting in Iraq is the export of American democracy. And so one could see, if you wanted to trace it out, a lineage between Jackson and President Bush, in the sense that Jackson confirmed the existence and future of democracy in the United States, and George W. Bush is trying to accomplish the same thing in Iraq. One caution that I would say about that whole project, though, and this is something that comes out, I hope, clearly in my book, because one of the points that I make is that This also goes to the heart of, I think, why Jackson is underappreciated today. We have lived so long with democracy as to come to take it for granted, and in common discussion, to treat it as though it's an undiluted good thing. And so, if you listen to this administration, and frankly, if you listen to much of the commentary, even on the part of critics of this administration, there's this notion that if democracy can take hold in Iraq, then mission accomplished, and the Middle East will be on the trajectory toward a better future. That may or may not be true. But if I look at the history of democracy in the United States, I would point out that although Jackson was the herald of democracy, and during the Jacksonian era, democracy became entrenched in the United States, it nonetheless had a rocky go of things. And furthermore, democracy guarantees that your government, your system of government, will be at best no better than the people that it's governing. And so, for example, one of the modern complaints against Andrew Jackson is his policy toward Indians. Well, it wasn't simply Jackson's policy to remove Indians from the eastern part of the United States and to transport them across the Mississippi. That was the policy of American democracy. The celebrated case, the notorious case of Jackson and the Cherokees arose from a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in response to a lawsuit that the Cherokees brought against the state of Georgia. The Cherokees applied through the American court system to have overturned some Georgia laws that were going to make the Cherokees, who consider themselves an independent tribe, subject to the laws of Georgia. And the Cherokees won. And Jackson is reported to have said, I have no reason to believe he actually said this, but it certainly reflected his view. Jackson is reported to have said, Justice Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. Well, as I explained a little bit earlier, to some extent this reflects Jackson's view that the Supreme Court decisions were not automatically binding on the president. But nonetheless, when Jackson thought about, even if he had been inclined to agree, it would have been an impossible decision to enforce, given the mood of Americans at the time. Because to protect the Cherokees in Georgia from their white persecutors would have meant raising a federal army, which didn't exist at the time. He couldn't have used militia, because the militia, the Georgia militia, were exactly the ones persecuting the Cherokees. It would have required raising a federal army and appealing to Congress for the money to do so. Well, Congress wasn't going to spend money to protect the Cherokees and keep the Cherokees in a place where most people in Congress didn't want them to be. My point in all of this is that the policies that Jackson is often criticized for were not simply Jackson's policies. They were the policies of young American democracy. And I would also contend that the Civil War represented, the U.S. Civil War represented a singular breakdown in American democracy. So, if democracy is going to take hold in Iraq, much like democracy took hold in the United States, then brace yourselves, because we're in for a rocky road that might end successfully, but maybe after a big civil war in Iraq. Anyway, I don't know if I fully answered you. I don't even think I partly answered your question, but I probably used up enough time on it. Sorry.
Okay. Another question. Let's have one gentleman right here.
Which one?
Well, right here is what I saw first.
One question for each author. At Jackson's inauguration party, I recall in my college history, it was described as a vulgar, awful affair where common people were trampling mud through the White House. Is that an accurate description?
That's an understatement. In fact, when Jackson was inaugurated in March of 1829, about 10,000 of his supporters, predominantly from the West, descended on Washington, D.C. They seemed to the longtime inhabitants of the Capitol to be very much, and this image recurs in descriptions, seem very much like the barbarians who invaded Rome in the 5th century. And they did. Jackson held a reception. Presidents before had held receptions for their inaugurations, but they were rather genteel affairs. Jackson's inaugural reception wasn't genteel at all. These thousands descended on the White House, and they filled the White House to bursting, almost literally. There was so much pressure inside, they opened the windows and burst out the windows. They broke the china, they knocked over the punch bowls, they tore the curtains, they smashed the furniture. It was a great day for the people, as some of the old-timers who were appalled by this remarked. They said, it's the people's day and the people shall have their way. And people like John Quincy Adams, who was vacating the office, thought that this was the beginning and the end, the beginning of the end of the American experiment in republicanism.
As to Grant and Sherman, what happened after the war? Did they continue their friendship?
Yeah, excellent question, and I do touch on that in the book. Although the main part, as the title suggests, is the friendship that won the war. But the friendship existed, but it came under some pretty severe pressure. Sherman realized that Grant was in the hands of politicians, and Sherman at different times was Secretary of War and General-in-Chief of the Army, and remained so. His total military service lasted 48 years from the time he was sworn in at West Point. They were never estranged. They saw somewhat less of each other. When Grant was dying of throat cancer and racing to finish his really remarkable memoirs, which he died 4 days after it, Sherman did come to see him, and Grant welcomed it and told Sherman that Sherman's visits did him more good than all the doctors. So it did survive, but it certainly went under some strains, and perforce was not as close as it had been before. But it's a very good question. I appreciate the chance to answer it.
Okay, let's take the gentleman on the to the left, on the aisle there.
Right. This question is for Mr. Flood. I was really moved by your book on Lee, that I've read it numerous times. And I would like to, and I also am aware that there's been quite a bit of history written about the difference between Lee and Grant as leaders of the two forces. But because of your understanding of Lee, I would really like to hear what you have to say about a comparison between the two.
Thank you. Of course, that's the question I really want to plant in every audience. I did not do it on this occasion, but anyway, I do believe Lee was the greater general, but not nearly by the margin that is commonly supposed. I think that Lee did a remarkable job with the resources at hand, but the idea that Grant just wore him down because he had behind him northern industrial power and lots of manpower is not true, because his predecessors, the Army of the Potomac, had all of that too and got absolutely nowhere with what they were doing. So if I may expand that slightly, and it's a wonderful question, I'd like to talk about it at some length, but if I may expand it slightly, in my pantheon of 19th century great generals, it's Napoleon, Wellington. I'm going to have to cede the exact place for Andrew Jackson to the gentleman on my left, but then we have Lee, Grant not at all far behind him, and then Sherman somewhat down behind Grant. So that's the short answer to one that I'd be happy to talk to you about for 20 minutes later on. But thank you for asking the question.
Okay, let's come over to this side, this gentleman, then we'll come back over to the other side.
For Professor Brand, Jackson is well known to many people as having quite a temper and also a projection of will, a projection of personal power. How would you connect that to the development of democracy in America? Is there a connection there?
I think one can find a connection. Jackson did indeed have quite a temper. And his temper, well, it was, Jackson was one of those people, when he was mildly angry, he would yell at whoever was the source of the anger. When he was really angry, he would get quiet. And when he got quiet, people knew to look out. Andrew Jackson fought a number of duels in his life. And the duels often started over some real or imagined slight, but they escalated dramatically if the person that was on the other side of the debate, the argument, cast some aspersion on Rachel Jackson, and in particular on the origins of the marriage between Rachel and Andrew Jackson. Now, in fact, there are some real clouds over the early part of their relationship. The gist of it was that Rachel Donaldson was married to another man when she first met Andrew Jackson. But this fellow's name was Lewis Roberts, had abandoned her. And Rachel was stuck in the situation that women in the late 18th century were stuck by the fact that there were no general divorce laws. And in order to get a divorce, you had to appeal to the state legislature. Because Rachel and this fellow Roberts had been married in Virginia, this meant going to Virginia, which was almost out of the question for Rachel. Anyway, her marriage had fallen apart in any kind of moral or emotional sense. It was still legally in existence. Andrew Jackson and Rachel fell in love. And exactly what they did then was the subject of great dispute during Jackson's lifetime. And it's still a matter of historical debate. My interpretation is that they simply fell so madly in love they decided to elope, not thinking really through the consequences. They were young and in love, and maybe more to the point, neither one had any idea that Andrew Jackson would grow up to be famous, and anyone would check up on this. And so, ultimately, her divorce came through, but after they had been living as husband and wife for a couple at least years, nonetheless. And so then they made it technically correct, and they explained away the confusion around the origins by saying, oh, they thought the divorce had come through, but it hadn't. Nonetheless, for the rest of his life and her life, if anybody wanted to get a reaction out of Andrew Jackson, that person would simply say, and what about the way you stole another man's wife. Now, Jackson took insults to himself rather poorly. He was a sensitive guy, and he had a high sense of honor. But he didn't take any slights of Rachel at all. And in one of these controversies he got in, this man cast aspersions on Rachel's honor. They had a duel, and Jackson killed the man. Now, when Jackson was running for president, this was often thrown back against him. He's so hot-tempered that he has this murderous temper, in fact. And how can he be trusted with command of the United States, of the forces of the United States, and as head of the executive branch? Well, I happen to think that this was exactly the sort of thing that endeared Jackson to very many of the people who voted for him. Because Jackson never apologized. Jackson was the only president to have killed a man in cold blood. And this cold, I'm counting as this duel, as cold blood, because he had cooled off by the time he was smoldering underneath, but Jackson never apologized for it. He never denied it. He simply said, the man deserved killing. He insulted my wife. And the kind of people who voted for Jackson thought that that was perfect grounds for killing a man. Now, needless to say, the more fastidious sorts thought this was taking things a bit too far. But I think this temper and Jackson's reaction to this sort of thing was precisely the sort of thing that endeared him to a lot of people. And it just made Jackson seem much more human. It was a lot easier to identify with Andrew Jackson than it was for most people to identify, for example, with John Quincy Adams.
All right, we have some competition, but the first gentleman in the gray, the darker sweater.
Yes, that's me.
We'll get to you.
Thank you. A Philadelphia connection question for each of you. One is Jackson and Biddle. Did they know each other? Did they maybe come to duels? I guess it wouldn't have been quite like that. But do you have a story on that one? And also Grant and Sherman and McClellan, who was in this part of the world. I don't know whether McClellan went off and ran against Lincoln and was never heard of or worked professionally with Grant or Sherman at all, but those two connections.
Shall I go first?
No, go ahead.
Okay. The controversy between Jackson and Nicholas Biddle started out, shall we say, legally and even politically, constitutionally, but it became personal. It became personal when Nicholas Biddle, shortly after Jackson became president, Biddle had been director of the Bank of the United States for some years, arrived at the White House and proceeded to lecture this man he considered to be an ignoramus on how the banking system of the country ran, explained the principles of banking as though Jackson had never seen an accounts receivable or a deposit or anything like that. And Jackson was polite enough, but he came away from that meeting believing that this was exactly why what passed for a central bank in the United States could not be left in the control of people like Nicholas Biddle. Because the Bank of the United States, as it existed then, was essentially a private version of, the closest thing to a private version of the Federal Reserve System. It essentially made monetary policy for the United States. Jackson's first problem with it was he thought it was unconstitutional. But the second problem he had with it was he absolutely detested the arrogance that he perceived in people like Nicholas Biddle, who thought they knew better what the economy and people of the United States needed than the people of the United States themselves did. This controversy escalated when Nicholas Biddle, on the bad but interested advice of Henry Clay, applied for early renewal of the charter of the bank. Clay wanted to put the bank into play for the election of 1832, and Clay was going to support the bank and use this against Jackson. Well, it backfired when Jackson vetoed the bank on constitutional grounds. All of a sudden, it became an issue that played very well for Jackson, very poorly for Clay and Biddle. Biddle responded by engineering a financial panic in the United States. Imagine an evil Alan Greenspan, someone who's trying to wreck the economy of the United States. That's what Biddle was trying to do, to prove a point. Now, he would have considered himself high-minded enough, despite the fact that he regularly bribed members of Congress. In fact, there's a great letter from Daniel Webster, the distinguished Daniel Webster, the senator from Massachusetts, to Biddle saying, "My retainer has not been paid up. If you expect my continued support, get me the money right away." Okay, so Biddle is determined to show Jackson and the Jacksonians that they need the bank, they need Biddle. He engineers this financial panic. And Jackson takes this as further evidence that you can't leave the bank, you can't leave this central policy-making institution in the hands of people who are irresponsible to the people. And things simply got worse from there. So it was both a political issue and it was a very personal issue.
So if you think pay-to-play is a recent phenomenon... Okay.
The fact is that Grant, Sherman, and McClellan, they didn't have much to do with McClellan during the war. Grant did know McClellan slightly out in California, and at one point when McClellan was setting off being a member of the Corps of Engineers, which was a very elite outfit, Grant was supposed to get him some horses and equipment and so forth, which he in fact perfectly efficiently did, but he was drunk in the process. And later, as the war began, Grant tried to get on McClellan's staff, and McClellan wouldn't even come out of his office to see him. But other than that, I'd like to just go to the leadership theme, and the problem was McClellan really did not have that innate aggressiveness. Grant and Sherman to return, I beg your pardon, Grant and Lee to return to your question, Lee, for all his gentlemanly and genuinely gentlemanly behavior and lineage and all that, was the most aggressive man in the Confederate Army. Grant was the most aggressive man in the Union Army, and Sherman certainly didn't lack any aggression, as he certainly demonstrated as he disemboweled the South. So I'm not ducking your question, but it's just there wasn't that much interaction among the war to be able, among the three of them during the war, to be able to give you any really meaningful response to that, I think. Thank you.
Okay, great. All right, woman right here.
I'm interested to know whether there's documentation on what Andrew Jackson personally felt and thought about the rights of the Native Americans.
I can give you some evidence. His public policy toward Native Americans as tribes was that they could not live safely, either safely to themselves or safely to the United States, within states as they existed. They could live as tribes in the unorganized territory west of the Mississippi River. In fact, Jackson did not narrowly insist that the Cherokees leave Georgia. He gave the Cherokees an option. He said, "You can, if you want to remain intact as a tribe, subject to your own laws, then you must withdraw from any existing state. Because Jackson had sufficient respect for states' rights that he thought states ought to be sovereign over everyone who resided in their borders. If the Cherokees wanted to stay in Georgia, then they would have to be subject to the laws of Georgia, just the way everyone else was. Okay, that was Jackson's public policy. And because the Cherokees and other tribes wished to continue living as tribes, it amounted to the Cherokees and the other tribes have to evacuate beyond the Mississippi. Now, in Jackson's personal relations with Indians, for whatever it's worth, when William Weatherford, as he was called among whites, who was the leader of the Creek Indians during the so-called Creek War, which was actually part of the War of 1812, Weatherford had been the author of a massacre of white settlers at Fort Mims. And this was actually what brought Jackson and the Tennessee Volunteers into the Creek War. Weatherford was responsible for this massacre. Jackson chased him all over the South, finally inflicted a devastating defeat on Weatherford and the hostile Creeks at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. Weatherford escaped, but he later basically turned himself in. And Jackson, while his troops were baying for the blood of Weatherford, simply said, "Go back to your people, tell them the war is over, and let Weatherford go his own way." In addition, Jackson adopted at least two Indian children, orphans from the war, whom he raised as sons of his own. So what you make of that, and I'll leave to you, but there is this, and it sort of reflects the two sides of Andrew Jackson. I didn't get a chance to develop this much. I alluded to it in mentioning his relationship with Rachel. But in public and as, call him, let's say, in his role as defender of the Union, Jackson was absolutely ferocious. In private, he could be as tender as one could imagine. And this comes out in his attitude toward Indians as tribes and his attitude toward Indians as individuals.
Okay. Yes, there, and then we're going to go back even further.
Okay.
Professor Brands, you've written about so many different people. If you had your choice to spend a day to interview one of your subjects, who would it be?
Now, that's a good question, because I haven't thought of it in those terms. I have thought about it in terms of who would you like to have as a house guest for 3 or 4 years, because I've experienced that. And any biographer does that. I'll relate to I wrote a biography of Benjamin Franklin. I wrote a biography of Theodore Roosevelt. I wrote a biography of Andrew Jackson. I wrote a small biography of Woodrow Wilson. And I've got Wilson stories, but I probably don't have time to get into them. But just taking the three that I spent a whole lot of time with. I will say that Jackson was kind of a phenomenon. Jackson was somebody who would have been a great house guest if I could count on him being my friend. Jackson was a friend to a fault. He was, if Jackson was your enemy, watch out. But if Jackson was your friend, in fact, Jackson's friends often took advantage of his friendship. He was too loyal to people at times. Jackson was, for all his rough-hewn origins, quite the gentleman. People were utterly amazed on visiting Jackson in the White House that he had all of the personal skills of a Southern gentleman, which he eventually became, although, as I say, he started out kind of rough. Now, between Theodore Roosevelt and Benjamin Franklin was a terrific house guest. Benjamin Franklin was the one who said that fish and guests stink after 3 days. Well, Franklin still smelled like a rose after 4 years. And with Franklin, I constantly felt as though I was in the presence of a very wise person. And I would be reading through Franklin's letters, and he would say something that simply struck me as exceedingly insightful into the human condition. Now, my wife says it's simply because I agreed with him on a lot of stuff, and maybe that's so. But now, as for Theodore Roosevelt was a harder guy to live with. I'm going to tell you just briefly an anecdote that occurred to me while I was thinking about Theodore Roosevelt. Some years, the Texas State Capitol was built in the 1880s. Texans brag about the fact that it's bigger than even the capital of the United States. And, you know, everything's bigger in Texas. It's taller, but it's not quite as broad. Anyway, back in the early 1980s, the Capitol was being refurbished. There is a statue on the top of the Capitol in Texas, on the top of the dome, just there is in Washington. And it hadn't been touched for the 100 years since it had gone up. So they brought in one of these big helicopters, these big double-rotored helicopters, to lift this thing off. And it was written up in the papers that this was going to happen. And so everybody who was interested would go down there by the Capitol grounds. And so I took my elder son, who was then about, 4 years old, and I was pushing him in a stroller. He was kind of slow walking. I mean, he's lazy that day. Anyway, so I was pushing him around. And so we watched as the statue was taken off, you know, with a brrr, and they lifted it off, and they lowered it right on the grass of the Capitol grounds.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.